It is 22 minutes after the hour. We welcome Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, into the studio. And, well, that's not strictly true, because you're in Columbia, Maryland. You're not in the studio, but you might as well be. We can see you, and you're sounding good this morning. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, guys, and I feel like I'm in the studio. It's a virtual studio,
well,
so why not?
It certainly is. It certainly is. And your timing's right. I'm thinking, timing is everything, isn't it? I mean, if you do the right thing at the wrong time, it doesn't work. If you do the wrong thing at the right time, it doesn't work either. It's the right thing at the right time that counts. And it's the Christmas season, and December 25th always comes up. Why December 25th? We've talked about the birth of Christ before, and it's unlikely he was born on December the 25th. So that's a date apparently that was contrived by the church for whatever reason in the early years, probably the Roman church in the 3rd or 4th century. Jesus, though, was born at a special time. We've talked about this, too, probably at about the same time the Paschal lambs were being born, which puts him in, what, spring, summer? And I'm wondering about how God orchestrates events to multiply the effect of the evidence we see with our eyes. If we also consider the time frame and how things are timed, it becomes that much more persuasive, convincing proof that God is involved in this.
Well, you know, to comment in a parallel fashion, in the real estate world, location, location, location is
yeah.
the mantra.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at things from God's perspective, timing, timing, timing is his perspective. And as we move into this Advent season, Paul's phrase, the fullness of time has come, echoes. And there's a remarkable contextual perspective behind that phrase, the fullness of time has come. Because if you're a Jew, God has been silent for over 400 years. The book of Malachi ended, and we've not heard from God. There have been no prophets. There have been no messages. And if you're like Zechariah, and now that the Roman Empire has conquered your part of the world, you might be saying, where is God? Why has he allowed this to happen? What is going on? It's a dark time.
No, we don't even have any scriptural writings from that time. You know, after the temple was reconstructed, there's Nehemiah and Ezra. But after that, the Bible is quiet, isn't it?
It is, but that doesn't mean that God has not been at work creating the stage, setting the stage for the fullness of time to come. In this intervening 400 years, let's call it the intertestamental period, the Roman Empire has been birthed, and about the time of Augustus has reached its zenith. The whole known world, by and large, has been conquered, and for the first time in human history, there is physical peace. Heretofore, there were always roving bands of bandidos and bandits and robbers who could carry you or your possessions off into captivity. And so life was precarious. And if you recall Maslow's hierarchy of needs from psychology 101, maybe it's sociology 101, until physical security exists, you can't think about anything higher. Like, why am I here? What is life about? And so God has indeed been at work bringing using the Roman Empire to create physical peace.
You know, I imagine somebody in the Holy Land standing outside and waiting to hear armies and drums and bugles and things, because it's been going on like that for 200 or 300 years. Alexander the Great conquered the area, and then the Romans came after that. I wonder if it impressed the people of the time that, hey, it's quiet out there. Nobody is threatening my life today.
Well, it's quiet, but you're also being governed by an evil empire. Satan is viewed as the chief operating officer of the Roman world by an observant Jew. So it may be quiet, but you're nevertheless feeling very heavy and very dark. But at the same time, speaking of Alexander the Great, he comes into this land, and he subjugates this land, and begins to import Macedonian city-states into this land wholesale. And into this land comes Greek philosophy, which is going to create a whole series of issues for Judaism, but also the Greek language, which turns out to be the perfect language for what Paul and the Gospels are going to be writing about, the Gospel writers, okay? Remember, when the Southern Kingdom was carted off to Babylon in 586 BC, Hebrew, over several hundred years, got corrupted by Aramaic. It's no longer what you'd call a viable language for the masses. And Hebrew, in its lexicon, only has about 7,000 words. Greek has over 30,000 words in its lexicon. It's a more elegant, a more nuanced language than Hebrew would be. And thus, it's the perfect language to carry Paul's theology and the subtleties and the nuances of what Paul talks about for the rest of time.
Is this reflected in what we read? I'm thinking Old Testament and New Testament. There's a sea change in the feeling of the text from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Is the change in language part of that?
It is, but it also makes it important to understand Hebrew. If I can make a very poor example here, there are only 7,000 words in Hebrew, give or take. But they have layers of meaning. And so, you know, you really have to penetrate the understanding of the Hebrew to see the layers of meaning that we so often miss. Whereas the Greek language takes all those layers and makes them into separate words that you can draw upon and use. All right? Just very different languages. And from God's perspective, the Greek language was going to be the perfect language to bring the gospel, the good news, to the world for the rest of the days until Jesus comes again. So that's the second thing that was going on. The third thing that was going on was you need a distribution system if you've got some good news that you need to distribute quickly and efficiently around the world. And God uses the Roman Empire to build, and their estimates vary here, from 60,000 to 80,000 miles of Roman roads. The perfect distribution system for the good news. So there's physical peace. There's a distribution system in place, and the perfect language is in place. The fullness of time has come, and now it's time to call for the angel Gabriel and get him ready to bring his messages that we see in Luke 1. Hmm. The fullness of time. Kind of neat, isn't it?
That's kind of awesome is what it is. I mean, it shouts planning, design, purpose.
Intentionality.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but divine purpose and intentionality, because there's no human force that could do that, that has that much knowledge, that much power to execute something like that.
And the message here, among others, is that just because God is silent does not mean God is not at work. He's just at work in ways that we cannot see, let alone understand. But he is always at work, preparing the world for what is to come next in his eternal plan. A plan, by the way, that was conceived before the world began. How's that for an awesome thought?
Mm-hmm. It is. It is.
So anyway, now Gabriel has got to go on a mission. He has to go to the temple, to the holy place, and encounter a very ordinary priest named Zechariah, whose name means whom Jehovah remembers. But he and his wife Elizabeth have been barren for at least 30 years, and he's probably not thinking whom Jehovah remembers. He's probably thinking whom Jehovah has forgotten.
Well, he's about to retire, isn't he? He's about done his duty.
I won't take us through the calculation and the estimation of that, but I think he's in the last year of a 30-year ministry. He continues to go to the Chamber of Hewn Stone, where every morning they form a circle, and they do the lot casting process to determine who's going to do the incense offering today. It's such a prestigious offering because it puts you next to the holy place, the Holy of Holies. And therefore, you're only entitled to do this incense offerings once in your lifetime. So every year, people drop out, and new young priests move in year after year after year for 29 years. You got to get the picture here. Zechariah is the old gray beard standing in this lot selection circle, at this point in time. Everyone else in the circle is younger than he is. He sticks out like a sore thumb, and all the younger priests are wondering, why is the old man still here? Why has he never been chosen? Oh, his wife is barren? They must have offended God, both he and his wife. We don't know how or why, but it's very clear they're barren, and the rabbis have said, and when a rabbi speaks, he speaks authoritatively for God to his disciples. There are only two reasons you cannot argue that God is disciplining you because he loves you. One is leprosy, and one is barrenness. So there is Zechariah, taking with each increasing year the wonderings of what everyone else is thinking, even wondering to himself, what we must have done to offend God. I can't imagine it, but we must have done something. And then in his last year before he retires, sent out to pasture, he gets selected. What would be going through your mind if you were Zechariah at that moment in time?
Shock, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if joy would have entered into it. I think shock and surprise.
Fear. Oh, my goodness. Am I finally going to find out what we've done wrong? I don't know. Why now? Why me? I don't get it. But nevertheless, he moves forward. And this is the third hour of the afternoon, around 3 o'clock, the third offering of the day, the incense offering. He walks up the steps, the Nicanor steps, into the holy place. He has two assistants with him. One is carrying the incense per se, that's going to be put over the fire. The other is carrying hot coals that they've just taken from the great altar. And it's put in an urn and it's being carried in and it's dumped out. And the incense is then dropped on these hot coals. And that particular kind of incense suddenly it creates a white smoke, which then begins to ascend, and that's the symbolism of the ascending prayers of the people. And as this white smoke starts to ascend upwards, all of a sudden, there's an angel. And Zechariah says, what do you think he's thinking now?
Fear.
Now we're going to find out what Elizabeth and I have done wrong.
And by the way, speaking of Elizabeth, barrenness is about the worst thing that could happen. I mean, that's how a woman's worth is measured, isn't it, in that time, in that place?
The sole role of a woman is to have a fruitful womb, to procreate, absolutely. And we've talked about Elizabeth's shame in past mornings here, so I won't redevelop that. But at this moment in time, the angel encounters Zechariah in the holy place, picking up verse 11 of Luke 1. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. Going on to verse 18, where he has just heard that he is going to have a son. Okay? Now, pause for a moment. I don't think it dawned on Zechariah. Whoa, wait a minute. I was never forgotten. If there's an angel here speaking to me, I have been remembered by God. But I doubt whether that thought went through his mind, because when we get to verse 18, Zechariah asked the angel, how can I be sure of this? I am an old man, and my wife is well along in years. Okay, so let's go back through this again. The angel appears. He tells him, basically, that he's not only going to have a son, but his son is going to be the forerunner for Messiah. Zechariah is the first person in Israel to hear that Messiah is coming. And his only reaction is a biological one. How can I have a son? My wife has gone through menopause, basically. Okay? It's just stunning to me.
The parallel with I'm thinking of Sarah, who laughed at the announcement. When you don't believe an angel, the shock the surprise, the questioning, the curiosity that comes with that. Abram and Sarai, I suppose, but the parallel is striking.
Yeah, and there's quite a bit of unbelief here.
Mm-hmm.
The angel has just informed him that God says, you're going to have a son, and he cannot accept that. He can't believe it. Because he's hung up on the biological understanding from his earthly world human view. Isn't it? I mean, a lot of times God speaks, right? And we sort of hear it, but we don't really hear it. And our reactions are rooted in the limitations of our own humanity. Anyway, I've always been struck by, he's the first person to know that Messiah is coming, and his only preoccupation has to do with biological function.
Pretty human reaction.
Absolutely. So now the angel says, I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to tell you this good news, and now you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens, the birth of his son, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at their appointed time. Back to the fullness of time as a concept, okay? So now, if you're Zechariah, you have been struck silent, and many commentators think now he is both deaf and dumb, okay? But in the protocol of being an ordinary priest who does the incense offering, the third offering of the day, he now has to go back out through the main entranceway there, stand at the top of the Nicanor steps, and give the benediction. And for the first time, I'm guessing, in the history of the temple's sacrificial system, the officiating priest of the incense offering cannot utter the closing benediction. How is that for notoriety? Now everybody knows about you. You've been a part of something that's never happened before. Not only you're no longer the priest wondering if anyone even knows you exist or even God knows you exist, you're the sort of the center of notoriety.
And you can't anyway. And you can't speak. So I'm thinking that his compatriots, the other priests, what do you suppose their reaction would be?
Well, they're stunned as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose he's trying to explain what just happened inside in the holy place, but I don't know how good his hand communications would be, like playing charades without having the ability to speak. But anyway, to wrap this up, he now starts a journey home at the end of his week-long service here. And his issue is, how's he going to explain this to Elizabeth?
Mm-hmm.
He can't speak. Can't he? Deaf and dumb. And how's he going to frame this? So, being a little bit creative here, my guess is he finds a piece of slate somewhere along the way and a piece of chalk, and he gets home. He walks inside his humble one-room home in Ein Karim, and Elizabeth says, "Hey, Zach, how'd it go?" And he can't respond. And he tries to explain that he's deaf and dumb. And Elizabeth says, are you deaf, Zach? What's with it? And finally, he's able to express a little bit of what happened, and he writes on his slate, "Liz, we need to try it one more time." And she breaks out in laughter. Excuse my speculation here. But what a poignant moment. How did he communicate this to her? How did she receive that message? Did they laugh? Did they cry? Did they both laugh and cry? How implausible is this scene?
I'd love to see that dramatized. You know, maybe it has been. I don't know. But wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, so we can pick up next time what happens now when Mary shows up on the doorsteps of Zachariah and Elizabeth and Ein Karim and take it from there.
And we will look forward to that. Doug Greenwald is a senior teaching fellow at Preserving Bible Times. It's just a super organization whose mission it is to fill in the blanks, tell us what exists between the lines and the white spaces in Scripture. It's the context, the historical, the linguistic, the cultural context. And I'd recommend a visit to their website, preservingbibletimes.org. And you'll learn a lot and be delighted by it. It's a beautiful site. can even sign up for Doug's monthly newsletter there that he calls Reflections. And it comes to you in email, no cost to you, and you'll look forward to that. Honest to goodness, the Reflections, preservingbibletimes.org. Doug, have a great week. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks, guys. Shalom, bye. Shalom.
See you, Doug.